I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Well, folks, we are moles in the ground, all of us, rooting those mountains down. Ordinary folks of an extraordinary species. As pointed out by that great poet, Karl Marx, with a wonderful poetic quote, which I will now read, a spider conducts operations that resemble those of a weaver, and a bee puts to shame many an architect in the construction of her cells. But what distinguishes the worst architect from the best of bees is this, that the architect raises his structure in imagination before erecting it in reality. That is, we humans, we think, we imagine, we build new realities. And in this process of making and remaking the world, we evaluate our current world arrangements. Today, we're coming to recognize that those current arrangements, dominated and shaped by what we call capitalism, they are moving towards human extinction. But also in the process of making the world, us humans can and are imagining the good society, one not moving towards species suicide. And in fact, we see all around us the tools for building better, democratic, sustainable world. And we have no time to waste. And this old mole, we of course critique those current arrangements, a particularly predatory and dangerous form of capitalism. We also highlight the struggles to build that better possible necessary world. Today on The Mold, I'm Bill Resnick, your host. My interview explores today's drug wars that's destroying so many in this country and around the world. It also explores the solutions, like amazingly can be seen full scale in the country of Portugal. Well, what have they done? Stay tuned. Also on The Mole today, Jan Hocken examines the psychology and politics of national borders. Later today, Larry Bolden reviews the life work of Ivan Doig, in particular his last novel, Last Bus to Wisdom, published the year he died. Doig is known primarily as a writer of the Western United States, but his writing is really about working-class folks. His characters take on corporate monsters like Anaconda Copper and the huge sheep and cattle ranchers that attempt to push out the small homesteaders. That's who Doig championed. Finally today, how to defeat Trump. One thing sure, exposure alone will not succeed. As to music today, we're doing Drug Songs 1, Anti-Drug, and several excerpts from Grandfather Flash's great leading white song, White Lines, that attacks drug abuse. It also attacks the anti-drug wars and the anti-drug industry.
Vision, dreams of passion. And all the while I think of you. A very strange reaction. The more I see, the more I do. Baby.
Hi, Jack Davies. Welcome to KABU.
Hey, thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Jack Davies is fighting the drug wars, trying to stop them and radically change drug policy. He has much experience in that, having worked to fight for medical marijuana and use of other psychedelics. Then he worked for the American Civil Liberties Union on drug law reform. Now he's with the Drug Policy Alliance, which is one of the few left reform organizations with the funds to work in the federal government and in many of the states, and with funding to support anti-drug war projects. So Jack Davies' public attitudes towards addictive drugs and drug policy, too, and the best ways to deal with the many damages of drugs and drug wars, they're rapidly shifting and changing. Now it's poor whites, urban, suburban, rural, that are increasingly obtaining and using and dying from prescription drugs, and that especially in Trump states. Trump has apparently now declared a drug emergency, and they're going to do something at the federal level, I'm afraid, of what? Maybe to intensify the current system, maybe to declare martial law or waive or reduce the scope of the Fourth Search and Seizure Amendment. anything is possible for them. Jag, let's start at the beginning. Tell us about the current scene. Why a declaration of emergency? What might we expect from them? And then we can get into the really main body of this interview, which is all the wonderful solutions that the Drug Policy Alliance is fighting for.
Yeah, this is a really pivotal moment for drug policy and criminal justice reform. You know, on the one hand, we have a federal administration now that is really determined to ramp up the drug war, which never really ended in a lot of ways. I mean, it sort of plateaued after three decades of skyrocketing in the 80s and 90s and 2000s. Some of news headlines and stuff like that said Obama ended the drug war or things like that. And you know, it really just kind of plateaued. It never went away. And we've made a lot of progress, though, at the state level and at the local level. I mean, with drug policy reform and criminal justice reform and public health reform, you know, the state and local levels is always the first place to make changes and make reforms. I mean, the federal government, no matter who's in office, is always going to be the last one to adopt cutting-edge policies. So even with Trump and Sessions in office, a lot of states like Oregon, but and even states in the South and places you wouldn't expect are moving forward with drug policy reforms, essentially move drug policy out of the criminal justice system and into more of a health-based approach as much as possible. For example, in Oregon just this year, the criminal penalty for drug possession and some other low-level crimes was reduced from a felony to a misdemeanor. But there's still about 30 states around the country that still treat drug possession as a felony, not just as a misdemeanor. And, you know, this is a huge driver of not just mass incarceration, but also mass criminalization. You know, there's 2.2 million people in prison in this country, by far the highest in the world, and about a quarter of them are there simply for a drug law violation. But then you look even at the bigger picture of mass criminalization, there's those 7 or 8 million people who are under some form of criminal justice supervision. And for these things like drug possession, where you have, even in 2016, the last year Obama was in office, there were 1.5 million arrests for drugs, and about 1.3 million of these arrests were just for drug possession. That's a huge number of people, and I think it probably goes without saying for a lot of your audience, but it's worth pointing out, huge discrepancy in the racial disparities, where a lot of white people do get arrested for drugs because the drug war is so huge, but people who are black are 3, 4, 5 times more likely to be brought into the criminal justice system for drugs, even though black and white people, statistically speaking, according to all the data we have, they use and sell drugs at similar rates. It's just the level of police interactions that they have when you take an activity that half the population has done at some point in their life and you criminalize it, you know, it just gives the police an excuse to do a lot of things. And so that's why, even though now we have huge public support for ending the drug war, it's very slow to unwind it because it's so entrenched at so many levels of the system. And of course, police and prosecutors and lots of other vested interests don't want to lose their bread and butter.
Also, it's highly corrupting for all of those people, the enforcers, not to mention what happens to the families and the people who get ensnared in it. They wind up with a record of drug possession and stuff, and they can't get jobs. The families get destroyed. The damage is so enormous, especially to the poor, in fact, I mean, to the lower half, and their capacity just to, in fact, make it an American life, even at a subsistence level. But it's also extremely corrupting for the police because, even at the ground level, they have to violate the Constitution to make their arrests. So they learn how to lie if they ever get on the witness stand. It corrupts police completely. It takes a huge amount of time. It adds to the militarization. They have to match the gunnery of the drug lords, is what they say, right? So they've got, that's part of the reason that they have tanks sitting around in the huge machine guns and all the rest of this apparatus that they like to use and dress up in and do their thing. They learn how to violate the Constitution, and then they want to change the Constitution to make it easier. It seems to me that drug wars now, they both destroy people, but they're also destroying society and sort of any sense, any possibility of the rule of law.
Yeah, it corrupts public institutions, and you see this happen all over the world as well in a lot of countries that are drug-producing countries where the amount of money being made from drugs is so vast that they end up with more resources than the government. See this happening in dozens of countries around the world. Not only have we done this to ourselves, we've exported this to the rest of the world as well. And yeah, it's hard to even measure the full impact of it, because you think of the knock-on effect, the economic effect of when you have tens of millions of people in the country with a criminal record for a low-level drug violation. Once you have a criminal record, you know, it's very hard to get a job. It's very hard. You go to school, like everything you do, you apply for a loan from a bank, or you apply, you know, for financial aid, for school, or, you know, the kind of things people need to do to, like, get their lives together, and you're discriminated against. You're punished again over and over again throughout your life. And we're realizing now there's a lot of attention now on bail reform, because what people are really realizing now is that about at least half of the people in local jails are generally there just because they're too poor to make bail. So we're basically criminalizing poverty at the same time where wealth is becoming more and more concentrated in the upper echelons. And when you have an activity that, as you said, drug use is a victimless crime. You know, there's no complaining witness. You know, if someone gets robbed or someone is harmed, you have a complaining witness. So you have evidence there. With a drug crime, it's just basically the word of the policeman against right. someone. So that it's inherently very corrupting. And of course, you also have huge amounts of money involved. A huge part of the drug war, one thing that the EPA has had some success in reforming in some states, is a civil asset forfeiture, where if the government merely suspects you of being involved in a drug crime, they can seize all of your property, your cash, your house, your whatever. And there's actually more law enforcement agencies in the U.S. actually seize more money now from private citizens than the entire amount of all robberies in the country combined. We say that this is about, you know, taking down the big drug kingpins, and they need these laws to do that. But actually, almost all the seizures are of very small amounts of just like a few hundred dollars or a few thousand dollars. And again, they're mostly in poor communities of color. So basically what they're doing is they're just shaking down cash from poor people in huge, huge, huge quantities. And a number of states have passed reforms over the past few years. But again, it's one of those things that's very entrenched. It's now built into the police budgets, the assumption that they're going to be seizing a certain amount of money, that it's very hard to kind of unwind it.
One thing we have to say is that it may be more money than all the robberies, but it isn't more money than all the financial frauds, I'll tell you that. Now, there is a pot of money, some of them legal.
Yeah, and the really crazy thing about our drug policies is that the whole point of it is that it's supposed to be protecting us from the harms of drugs, where actually it's making drugs much more dangerous, and overdose deaths in this country have skyrocketed over the past few years. A lot of the blame has been put on prescription drugs, but now, over the past few years, many more people are dying of heroin and fentanyl poisonings, and that is a huge public health disaster that is not being sufficiently addressed. And we know the crazy thing about overdoses is that we know how to prevent them. There's countries like Portugal where they decriminalized all drugs and have a really robust health approach to drugs, where there's pretty much no overdoses. An overdose is easily reversible if someone gets medical attention, but it's largely because of the criminalization of drug use that people often don't seek medical help or don't have access to naloxone, the overdose reversal medication. So there's a lot that could be said about what needs to be done. That's a big part of DPA's work, is trying, you know, not just change the criminal justice system, but then also implement public health policies and health policies that actually do address the potential harms of drug use.
Yeah, I just read that about as many lives are lost to drugs, and in many of them just prescription drugs, of course, that's another thing we didn't get into, than are lost to guns and car accidents combined. It's unbelievable how many people are dying of drugs. This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Jag Davies, who works with the Drug Policy Alliance and their communications group. The Drug Policy Alliance not just exposes horrible, many harms of the drug wars, but the Drug Policy Alliance also promotes alternatives to the drug wars. Jag, tell us about Portugal. It's really leading the way in the world. It's had great success. Tell us what Portugal has done in all sorts of areas.
Yeah, well, Portugal and a number of countries in Europe don't criminalize drug use, where basically no one is brought into the criminal justice system simply for using or possessing a drug. And Portugal is the most well-known and most well-studied. Also, the Czech Republic, Switzerland have similar approaches, you know, but what we've seen in those countries is that after decriminalization happened, overdose deaths plummeted, HIV plummeted, addiction plummeted, and people assume that when you decriminalize drugs that, oh, well, more people are going to use drugs then, and that actually didn't happen. In fact, among youth, drug use is lower than it was than before they decriminalized. And a lot of that is because the people who want to get help are able to get help under that system. It wasn't just a criminal justice reform. At the same time they decriminalized drugs in Portugal, they also ramped up their health and harm reduction services so that treatment is available on demand to anyone who wants it. And they have very robust harm reduction programs that they don't have in the U.S., like drug checking programs, so that people can test their drugs to make sure they don't have impurities.
Apparently in Portugal, at some rock concerts and other big concerts where people, they have testing tables where people can come and they give them a small quantity and they test whether the drugs are actually good ones or they have impurities. And then they give the stuff back to the people. What they're doing is trying to root out some of the most damaging, medically damaging drugs.
The interesting thing is even in the U.S., a lot of places are taking steps in the right direction. We've already, of course, we've seen over the past couple decades, a lot of states have passed not just medical marijuana, but marijuana legalization laws and marijuana decriminalization laws. Also, sentencing reform. California and Oregon have reduced drug possession from a felony to a misdemeanor in the past few years. I mean, there's basically a political and public and scientific consensus at this point that drug use should not be criminalized. Even the United Nations and World Health Organization released a joint statement this year calling for the repeal of laws that criminalize drug use and possession. The American Public Health Association, the International Red Cross, even groups like the NAACP and the Movement for Black Lives that are focused on civil rights and racial justice have also supported decriminalization. So we're really not that far away from it. I mean, during the presidential election last year, it was very interesting to see you had Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders kind of like competing with each other for who could sound better on criminal justice reform, which you never had had before in any election, even in the Republican primary debates, besides not including Trump, but several of the other Republican candidates would say things like, oh, we can't criminalize addiction and we can't arrest our way out of the drug problem. There is a kind of like general consensus around that, both in the scientific, political, and public realm. So over the next few years, DPA is really, that's really our top priority now, is trying to mainstream and popularize the concept of decriminalization in the U.S. and to start introducing legislation and do ballot initiatives in several states that would do that. Last year, Maryland became the first state to introduce a bill to fully decriminalize drugs. It didn't pass, but it's going to keep getting reintroduced. So that's our goal looking forward to like 2020, for example. That's kind of the next logical step for the drug policy reform movement.
All of those changes, I think, can probably be also traced to the fact that it's now white people who are dying in huge numbers, and even in Trump states. The drug wars were really ways of putting a lot of blacks in jail, disobedient blacks, and often framed, in fact. We all know that there's marijuana in every black car, and the police can always find it during those days, or crack or whatever. Yeah. I mean, there were a lot of users as well, of course, black and white. But it seems to me partly it was really, as Michelle Alexander has pointed out, it's a part of the new Jim Crow. This is Cable Radio. Bill Resnick talking to Jack Davies of the Alliance. We've been talking about the harms of the drug wars. It's a terrible burden on all of us, and especially the people who are caught up in it, including the cops. It corrupts them. But there's also so many solutions. We discussed Portugal and a decriminalization, more treatment. Portugal also does a huge amount of outreach, actually, to people with drugs, asking them to please come in. It's not just waiting for people. It's, in fact, explaining their alternatives. Many of them don't want to stay on it. It's a tremendously effective program and not much money.
Yeah, there's an assumption I think people have that, you know, we need the coercive role of the criminal justice system to force people into drug treatment. But all the available evidence shows from the past numerous decades that coercive treatment is much less effective than voluntary treatment. When you treat people like human beings and give them the option, eventually most people do end up naturally recovering in some way, whether or not they go into a treatment program. And it's also worth noting, too, that the vast majority of people who use drugs do not use them problematically. This goes against conventional wisdom in some ways, but the data actually shows that about 80 to 90% of people who ever use crack cocaine, methamphetamine, heroin, the drugs we think of as the worst of the worst, actually do not go on to develop an addiction. But because there's so much stigma around them, our focus is so much on the problematic use of them. Whether someone has a problematic relationship with drugs, though, it never makes sense to bring them into the criminal justice system. That's just going to make the situation worse no matter what.
One final thing, Jack. Much of now the drug abuse in the United States has changed from illegal sources to, in fact, the drug companies themselves, who are now have gotten the right to manufacture a whole lot more opioids like fentanyl and oxycontin and the others.
Yeah.
And they're being diverted into the, quote, illegal market, right? It's easy to get them, and they're just flooding these areas, and a lot of people are dying from them, not from the stuff that comes from Colombia or Afghanistan or other places that have been...
The pharmaceutical industry in the late 90s played a role in fomenting the current opioid crisis, but I think it's also important to realize that a lot of people do have legitimate pain for which they need medications, and there's actually been a lot of laws the past few years cracking down on opioids, prescription opioids, and that has what led people to the illegal drugs. So, you know, we have to be careful. At the same time, yes, you know, the pharmaceutical industries were very irresponsible in how they promoted these medications, but at the same time, it's actually less dangerous to be using OxyContin than it is to be using heroin on the street. And what's happened over the past few years is that they've cut the prescription opioid supply a lot already, and people have switched to more dangerous drugs. So if they're going to be cutting the supply of legal opioids, what they need to also be doing then is making other forms of treatment much more available, like maintenance therapies and other forms of treatment. When you cut people off from opioids and then you don't have easy access to treatment, it's a recipe for disaster because you're pushing them into using much more risky and dangerous drugs. And now all the media attention is so much on the pharmaceutical drugs, but most people, the majority of people trying opioids for the first time now are using street heroin and fentanyl, and the vast majority of deaths are from street heroin and fentanyl. So there does need to be better regulation of the pharmaceutical industry for sure. They are not, I don't want to defend them, but at the same time, there's, I think, more to the story.
Jed Davies, it's really good talking to you. I'm afraid we have to end, but the drug wars are not going to end, and the struggles, in fact, are heating up. People should look at what your website is great, Drug Policy Alliance. Just go there. There's a lot of things to read. Jags, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you for having me. Great to be on your show.
I'd like to make one final comment on the drug wars and how we deal with drug abuse, an issue we just didn't have time for to talk about, how to deal with drug abuse. That Portuguese success is not just due to decriminalizing and the rest of it, wonderful programs. It also, though, must be attributed to Portuguese culture and how people live, because compared to this country, it's a lot more communal, less hierarchical, less individualistic. Not a rich country, it has a relatively real safety net and universal medical care. Well, all that makes a difference, because in any country, as economic fears and social isolation grow and good work diminishes, that creates a lot of anime, emptiness, anxiety, depression, and it's not just among the poor. And then that leads to the self-medication that follows. One thing's sure, if we create a society that's more communal, that values and respects everybody, that takes action to protect all its members, that gives offenders more chances, a society that doesn't impoverish 30% of its people and really oppress many of them and make nearly all precarious and anxious about whether and for how long they can pay the mortgage, a society in which all work has dignity, it's structured so that all are constantly learning new skills and developing, that they take meaningful roles, and particularly in the daily decisions of their workplace. In a society like that, people will live and work with much more positive experiences and feelings about themselves, and we're sure to have much less drug abuse. As old mole Clayton Morgridge pointed out in a recent commentary on this Old Mole show, it was played October 7th. So it was called A Sick Individual or A Sick Society. It was about the guy who did the shooting in Las Vegas. He pointed out, I quote, "As long as we allow the world to be governed in the interest of maximizing the wealth of an already wealthy elite and subordinating all values to money values, pathological behavior of many kinds will continue."
Pure as the driven snow,
connected to my mind,
and now I'm having fun, baby. It's getting kinda low,
'cause it makes you feel so nice.
I need some one-on-one, baby.
Don't let it blow your mind away,
baby.
Go to your little highway, 'cause white lines blow away.
Hi, folks. That was Grandmaster Flash. I'll talk about him a little soon, right now, in fact. But before that, I interviewed Jag Davies of the National Drug Policy Alliance on the great success of decriminalizing use and offering help, as demonstrated in Portugal. The two pieces of music we just played were from Grandmaster Flash, born Joseph Sadler, to Barbados immigrants who settled in the South Bronx. Grandmaster Flash became one of the pioneers of the great Bronx cultural explosion, hip-hop, of the late 70s and beyond. He started as a disc jockey and a master of cutting, scratching, mixing, at which he was a real genius and still emulated with great reverence. Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2007, the first hip-act to be honored. The song White Lines is about cocaine, urging listeners not to do it, while also making the case that drug laws in the U.S. are racist and just, since for a lot of reasons. It was the first hip rap song, one of the first hip rap songs about drugs, one of the first politically and, or as they call, socially conscious rap songs that then showed the way to groups like Public Enemy. Anyway, we're the Old Mole Variety Hour, coming to you every Monday at 9 a.m. on KABU, listener-supported radio. Later on today's Mole, Jan Hocken interviews Kapka Kasabova about her new book, Border, A Journey to the Edge of Europe, exploring the psychology and politics of borders and nationalism. Next on the Mole, Larry Bolden, an introduction and review of the novels of Ivan Doig.
Good morning. Today I want to pay tribute to one of the really memorable writers of the last century in the first part of this one. Ivan Doig was born in 1939 and died in 2015. His last novel, Last Bus to Wisdom, was published in the year he died. While I want to pay tribute to his entire oeuvre, I will focus in on the final work. Doig said of himself, quote, "I come from the lariat proletariat, the working class point of view," close quote. And certainly his novels that dealt with the massive Anaconda copper mine in Montana made clear that his sympathies lay with the miners, the sheep herders, the homesteaders, and not with huge agribusinesses and ranches that came to dominate the western frontier. I have to admit I came to Dog rather slowly. I found his early novels interesting as stories of the immigrant settlers of Montana, but spoiled reader that I am, I at first saw his writing as a little too simplistic, even rustic. I was used to marvelous women word weavers like Edith Wharton and Willa Cather. Indeed, I felt I had been shortchanged in my university lit courses, which focused almost entirely on male writers. And when I discovered I'd been assigned the long and rather dull Theodore Dreiser novels when I might have been reading the far superior Wharton, I pretty much gave up reading male novelists and concentrated instead on filling the huge gap in my reading, namely that of women writers. Still, Doig represented an important inroad for me back to male writers of the late 20th and early 21st century. Judging from his writing, I would say Doig is a good man, even a sweet one. And while I would not characterize him as a political novelist, he certainly wrote of and for common people. I've come to see almost all of his work as quite closely autobiographical. He was one of those rare writers who had bestsellers in both fiction and nonfiction. His superb portrayal of Montana, the nonfiction book, This House of Sky, is overtly autobiographical. But almost all of his novels have a young male narrator and a manner of speech, even a type of humor, that run like a vein through his works. In his final novel, the boy narrator, Donal, is orphaned at an early age and raised by his grandmother, who is a cook at various restaurants or for cattle and sheep ranches. Although she's a skillful and in-demand cook who could make a lot more money working in restaurants, she takes on the job of cook for the Double W Ranch in order to have Donal at her side rather than with sitters. Although I won't reveal too much of the story, I will tell you that his much-loved grandmother gets cancer and needs an operation and then a place to convalesce. While some nuns in their small Montana town agree to care for her after her operation, Donal has to be found a home until she recuperates enough to go back to work and reclaim him. He's put on a Greyhound bus, which he calls the Big Dog Bus, and sent clear across country to Wisconsin to live with his only other relative, his Aunt Kitty, and her husband, Dutch. About the first third of the novel is devoted to his cross-country bus ride and the many people he meets and gets to sign his autograph book, which he hopes will someday win the Guinness Book of Records for most autographs. Donal is a bit like Lily Tomlin's character, Edith Ann, who is accused of making up stories. While she objects, saying that the grown-ups mean by making up stories lying, and she doesn't lie, she then continues, "But you can make up the truth if you know how." Donal is certainly in this class of storytellers, and his heartwarming and wise story is so full of down-to-earth humor and naive goodness. He and Doig clearly know how to make up the truth. Unfortunately, his Aunt Kate is a self-absorbed and selfish woman who has no real feelings for her grandnephew and no idea at all of how to care for a young boy. Her only use for him is to teach him how to play canasta in order to fill in for one of the foursome who's dropped out. Between her screaming at her husband Herman, a.k.a. Dutch, and riding herd on poor Donal, he's facing a long and very boring summer. Turns out Herman, who is German rather than Dutch, is obsessively interested in stories of the Wild West and has spent a great deal of time reading a German author who writes of the shoot-'em-up West. It does not take Aunt Kate long to repent of her impulsive offer to care for Donal, and long before the summer is over, she simply sends him back to Montana, though she knows that her sister is in no condition to care for him, nor is there a place for him to stay. What could have been a sad and worrisome ride home on the Big Dog Bus becomes a wonderful rollicking trip when Uncle Herman decides to make his escape from his wife, whom he calls the Kate, by accompanying Donal. They head first for a big Indian carnival so Herman can finally see some Indians for himself. Doig writes about what he knows, and that means about sheep and cattle and the workers who tend them, and small-town newspapers. There's a quiet wisdom that bubbles up from the characters and events in his stories that would be difficult to put in capsule form. Suffice it to say that the more I read him, the wiser he seems, and I've also come to realize his rather plain style of writing serves very well for the stories he wanted to tell. While there is much heartbreak and hardship in all of his works, there's also shining examples of loyalty and solidarity. Doig resisted the title Western writer, and I can understand why. Yes, he writes of the West, of the people, but what he reveals is much wider than simply stories of the West. I'm so glad I allowed him to guide me back into an at least somewhat more balanced set of writers in terms of gender. Like Alice Munro and Elizabeth Strout, Doeg reveals the extraordinary in ordinary people and so-called ordinary lives. I've been talking today of the writer Ivan Doeg, and especially of his final novel, Last Bus to Wisdom. This is Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
No, I don't want you to go. A street kid gets arrested, gonna do some time. He got out 3 years from now just to commit more crime. A businessman is caught with 24 kilos. He's out on bail and out of jail, and that's the way it goes.
Hey, sugar. Hey, sugar. Hey.
Athletes rejected. Governors corrected.
Well, that was Grandmaster Flash, the song White Lines. On who gets exploited and jailed and killed and brain dead in the drug wars, and who are protected and get honored, even enriched, some of them, of course, the drug dealers and the people who protect them and all the people in the anti-drug war apparatus, as you heard in my interview with Jag Davies. Again, this is Grandmaster Flash's White Lines was one of the first political hip-hop songs. Before that, you heard Larry Bolden on working-class novelist Ivan Doeg. Stay tuned for Jan Hocken interviewing Kappa Kassavova about her new book, Border, A Journey to the Edge of Europe. Next on The Mole, I'm today's host, commenting on how to defeat Trumpism. So all sorts of Republicans are attacking Donald Trump now, including Senator Bob Corker, the Republican chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He charged in an interview with the New York Times that Trump was treating his office like a reality show with reckless threats towards other countries that could set the nation, I quote, on the path to World War III. Corker said he was concerned about Trump. You would have to be concerned about anyone who cares about our nation, Corker said, adding that the vast majority of our caucus understands that we're dealing with here, the volatility we're dealing with, the tremendous amount of work it takes by people around him to keep him in the middle of the road. Robert Reich, who's a very liberal, very active liberal writer, Secretary of Labor under Clinton, but a critic of Clinton, now a pundit, wrote that a senator that he'd known called Trump anonymously nuts, unfit, dangerous. He added, Trump's not just a moron, he's a despicable human being. He's getting crazier, paranoid, unhinged. Everybody knows it. I mean, we're up to our eyeballs in excrement. He used another word. Reich's essay, and that was from a senator of the United States, or confident of it. Reich's essay is so characteristic. It's like so many smart, knowledgeable, thoughtful people, liberals and further left, who are so appalled and fascinated they can't take their eyes off him. And like network TV and several cable stations, it's Trump all the time. They do it to gain an audience, of course, as so many people obsessed by the man, but they also feel that he must be stopped, and somehow, that is, if his absurd ideas and bizarrely mendacious presentation, that if it's exposed, that somehow, someday, he will be driven by power. Well, that leads to the question of how to stop him. And there's only really one way, that is to build movements of thoughtful people, because Trumpism is going to continue, and the whole corporate apparatus will continue. We have to build movements of thoughtful people committed to a vision of a new America, a democratic and sustainable America, and also sufficiently committed and knowledgeable to reach out and convince their families, their neighbors, their co-workers. That's our job, to, yes, expose Trump, but also to build those counter movements with the capacity to prevail, and the capacity to prevail over time into the future over the forces of corporate capital. Next on The Old Mole, Jan Hocken interviews Kappa Kassavova about her new book, Border, A Journey to the Edge of Europe.
Kappa Kassavova, welcome to KBOO.
Hello, thank you.
Yeah, well, your new book has been met with rave reviews for its gripping historical sweep and lyrical style, and its close attention to the inventiveness of people living under repressive conditions in the borderlands of Europe. It's been described as both a memoir and a travelogue, and unfolds as a return to what you clearly envision as a very enchanting and interesting region on the periphery of your own childhood in Bulgaria. Well, we'll talk a bit on the show today about your insights as they relate to nation wall building in the U.S. and nationalism here. But let's start by having you describe this region, these borderlands of your childhood in Bulgaria and the place that your family fled.
Well, this is really a place where three countries meet, but also two continents. The countries are Greece, Bulgaria, and Turkey, and it's really a continental confluence on the Black Sea. The region has been known since antiquity as Thrace. And this is where I went on a strange kind of fated pilgrimage, I suppose, because even though I didn't grow up in a border zone and my family were not border crossers during the Cold War, border crossing during my childhood, the last 15 years of the Cold War, was a very dangerous thing, and there were always distant rumors of people who had tried to cross, stories. Really, that border, our national border in Bulgaria, was the last southernmost outpost of the Iron Curtain. This was the Iron Curtain in not as a metaphor, but as a physical reality, an electrified barbed fence.
You sometimes distinguish hard borders and soft borders. This was a very hard border during the Cold War.
This is the ultimate hard border. If we judge borders by the degree of vulnerability, the degree of mortality, even that they engender whenever crossers approach them, or even in all innocence, you know, people in all innocence approach them like locals, then this was an ultra hard border, and It took its toll not only on the Bulgarians who lived there, but also on people from the entire so-called Eastern Bloc. Many East Germans, Poles, Czechs had heard that this particular border separating us in the East from the so-called West was the easiest to cross because it's a wilderness, and they went for it, and many of them were shot and killed on the spot by border guards. Yeah, I was also interested in what it was like to live in the border zone. I was interested in meeting locals, people who hadn't chosen to live there, but it was their fate.
And some describe this as the backyard, the back door of Europe, and that there was an understanding and a relationship of people who cross through this region, some fleeing, some stopped at the borders, being stopped at the borders, and you work with this idea that I found very interesting and perhaps applicable in a broader sense of how not everyone is stopped at the border, that there were different forms of checkpoint, different forms of passage during the Cold War, even in this very harsh and brutal border. That there's an inequality that's manifested in the traffic and border crossing.
Absolutely. Borders are a place of inequality, of borders like this one, of inequality, of injustice, of arbitrariness, of sometimes freak occurrences. And as you said at the beginning, of great, great inventiveness. And just as today's refugees coming in from the Middle East, from conflict, from war, are trying to cross this this border. This is the same border. It's not exactly the same fence. There has been a new fence built by the Bulgarians, but also by the Greeks to stop the influx of people from Turkey into the European Union. Just as people now are trying to cross through different points, some legally through the official checkpoints, others illegally across the forest, so it was during the Cold War. People from the Eastern Bloc didn't have the opportunity to cross legally. It was simply forbidden to leave the Eastern Bloc, so they went for the illegal option. And some of the stories are extraordinary. There are stories of successful crossings, of unsuccessful crossings, but there is a spectrum of the border experience from the Cold War. And what I found the most interesting was how the locals, how the border people and the border crossers' destinies intertwined, including those of border guards.
And you take up some of the loss of humanity of border guards. Earlier on the show today, there was a discussion of the corrupting effects of the drug wars here on policing and the whole apparatus of policing. And you take up some of that theme in your book as well, how corrupting and dehumanizing these borders are for border guards, as well as people who try to negotiate some form of passage.
Yeah, a hard border. I discovered in my encounters with people, a hard border creates a kind of microculture, a microcosm, really, of the dysfunctional society that it represents, and it continues, as it was the case with this border, this stretch of the Iron Curtain. It continues in its lifetime. Thankfully, the lifetime of every border is finite. That's another thing I discovered. It continues throughout its lifetime to create a kind of a culture of oppression and eventually self-oppression.
Yeah, and you take up the border as a object of the human psyche, as an object of the imagination and fantasy, as well as a harsh concrete reality. Can you speak to that theme?
Yeah, I was interested in talking to former Cold War era border guards, and there are a few of them who who still carry, a few of them that I met who still carry the wire in their heads, in their hearts, really. They have internalized the border. So not only are they not repentant or even aware of the acts they have committed, sometimes acts of murder, execution of unarmed civilians trying to cross the border, they continue to feel justified. So in doing that, in their sense of having fulfilled their duty of protecting the national border, and that's when you realize that even a generation after a border like that falls, the trauma, the spectral dimensions of the border are still very much there in the psyches of those who were most directly affected by it. And that includes the border crossers. I talked to a man, his story is in the book, from East Germany at the time, who attempted the crossing. And that was almost 40 years ago. And his story is extraordinary of how he has continued all these decades to carry that border in his mind and heart, and how it has affected his life thereafter.
In the West and much of the capitalist world, the project of dismantling borders has been central to neoliberal capitalism And capital is very mobile, increasingly mobile around the world, and transactions and investments can happen within a nanosecond. And that wealthy people also, and the affluent, have tremendous mobility across borders and through customs in the fast zones of the world. And at the same time, there's been a fortification and a militarizing of borders for everyday people and refugees. Do you see any parallels? Of course, in Eastern Europe during the Cold War, it was not the same project, but do you see any parallels between how you cast the history of this border in Eastern Europe and these inequalities in the global traffic of capital set against refugees who are stopped at various borders? What are the insights you have for this kind of border dynamic we're seeing in much of the world?
I found that that border, my border, was particularly rife in ironies from the past, ironies from the present, and a lot of kind of mirroring going on between the two sides. So, for instance, the refugees who are coming in, trying to come into Europe, the EU, via Turkey today, they're using pretty much the same routes as, the same corridors of movement through the forest, across the mountains, as during the Cold War. It's just that the direction of travel has changed. It is now to the north and the west.
So there's a lot of commercial activity along these are old trade routes as well.
Indeed, ancient, we might say, trade routes, but also medieval drove roads from the Ottoman Empire and so on. And yes, there is still a very lively trade attached to these illegal crossings, in people smuggling, in which, of course, the border police take a cut. And often refugees end up on the wrong side of the border, having been misguided there by a smuggler, and robbed of their last money. So there is tremendous drama and tremendous irony is going on in this area, not least because the local towns and villages in Greece, Bulgaria, and Turkey, the border villages, are extremely depopulated from the time of the Cold War. So there is a real shortage of a deficit of humans. You know, all these large village houses, the beautiful villages, standing empty. And at the same time, you know, the politics issued from the centers of power in these countries are very much against keeping refugees, keeping these people coming across the border in the country. You know, there is a fear and a suspiciousness, about these strangers coming into our territory, when in fact it would be quite a good idea to resettle families in these depopulated villages. It would probably save these countries, like Bulgaria and Greece in particular, from being drained of their lifeblood through extreme emigration and bad governance.
Yeah, well, Kapka Kasabova, your book invites us to share in this journey and to also draw insights that I think go beyond this edge of Europe itself. And I just want to praise you for a wonderful piece of work. It's a riveting read, and it's now available in the U.S. This month. You can purchase Border Journey to the Edge of Europe at a number of bookstores in the U.S., including Barnes & Noble's. Thanks so much for being with us this morning and for your wonderful work, Kapka Kasabova.
Pleasure.
A lot of great artists get affected by that. A lot of great art goes down a drain.
I caught you knocking at my cellar door. I love you, baby, can I have some more? Oh, the damage. much time. I hit the city and I lost my band.
That was Neil Young, Needle and the Damage Done. I watched the needle take another man. Gone, 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 the damage done. Neil Young was and is one of the good guys on many issues, the Iraq War, the Keystone Pipeline, all environmental issues. Before that, I reflected on Donald Trump, that he can only be defeated by organizing great counter-movements that are necessary. He and Trumpism that will go on, necessary for total, we can only prevail over that if we organize movements necessarily for totally reconstructing the economy and prospects for this country. On cable from Mainder, this movement, Locus Bogus, Barbara Bernstein, she hosts her weekly conversation about our place in the planet. On this episode, Barbara considers the Eagle Creek fire 6 weeks after it. At 11, it's disability awareness, women from Doctors Without Borders tell some of their stories of healing around the world. Voices for Animals at 11:30 about the steps pet owners can take to keep their animals safe in the event of both small emergencies and large-scale disasters. KABU keeps you informed, and you can get involved. Go to KABU.fm and click on Donate to become a member. I don't have time to do all of the thank yous. There are so many people, especially Patricia Kullberg, our wonderful novelist, KABU volunteer engineer, a tough boss but compassionate. Thanks to all of you out there who support this station, since we live stream and archive everything, all 24 hours a day programming. We get support from all over the planet. You can hear this show or any part of it again or any of our previous shows or recommend us to your friends. Just go to the web to KABU and go to the top right search box and type Old Mole or Old Mole Variety Hour. Thank you, folks. That's all.